Welcome to a live reading of the Boston Globe. This program is intended for our print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. For the next hour, we'll be bringing you news from the Thursday, August 6th, 2026 edition. As always, thanks to the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Mass Commission for the Blind for their ongoing support. This is Harry, along with Corey and Mark, live from the Patricia A. Fletcher Studio at Audio Journal in Worcester, Massachusetts, the center of the universe, or at least the center of Massachusetts. We begin now with Corey with the front page news.
Thank you, Harry. We'll start with today's page highlights. Massachusetts now has a sweeping immigration law designed to thwart President Trump's nationwide deportation surges. Using AI to create child sexual abuse material would be criminalized under an amendment passed by the state Senate. The family's former nanny testified that Lindsay Clancy was a loving mother struggling with postpartum issues. No one has yet reported any obvious signs of the impact caused when part of a SpaceX rocket slammed into the moon earlier in the week. Zidane Rafael has been a key factor in the Red Sox surge, and it's more than just his flashy glove that has made him an all-star. For today's story, we'll start with More Cyclospora Cases Here, But No Alarm, by Jason Laughlin, Globe staff. Cases of Cyclospora parasite, a parasitic infection that causes severe gastrointestinal symptoms, have spiked in Massachusetts, with 104 new ones reported in July. Despite the surge in cases, state health officials noted that number here remains modest in the context of a national outbreak of cyclospora, said Dr. Catherine Brown, the state epidemiologist. She described the increase in Massachusetts as noteworthy but not yet alarming. Looking at a number of cases other states are reporting, Brown said, noting that Missouri has identified nearly 1,100 since May, it's hard for me to get super concerned about what we're seeing so far. Federal officials have tied the national outbreak to iceberg lettuce from Mexico as a source of widespread outbreak. Taylor Farms, a produce company identified as a likely distributor of contaminated food, recalled all lettuce sourced from central Mexico on July 17th, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention reported. The agency has said other sources, including other produce brands, restaurants, and retailers, could be tied to the outbreak as the investigation continues. Black kids face more scrutiny on residency, Milton more likely to investigate homes, in some cases using police. By John Hilliard, Globe staff. Tucker Elementary School sits on tree-lined streets in the largely white suburbs of Milton, just blocks from the predominantly black but less affluent Boston neighborhood of Mattapan. Long a magnet for young families, Tucker has test scores nearly three times higher than those just over the city line. Only Milton residents may attend Tucker, where a quarter of the students are black. Town officials have focused unusual attention on Tucker. Its children, particularly black students, are more likely to be investigated for violating residency requirements than any other elementary school in Milton, according to a Globe analysis of public records and interviews with local families and school officials. In the previous academic year, more than half of students expelled from Milton schools over residency issues were black, including nine from Tucker. Milton's tactics stand out compared to other school districts. In some cases, the town says police officers to conduct surveillance of children's homes, going so far as to inspect the student's bedroom as part of residency investigations. By contrast, officials from seven other local school districts said they do not use police for residency checks. Camille's Sanabria Cooper, a black Milton resident with two children in the schools, said the desperate enforcement made her question the town's commitment to all children. Do they really have investments in our black and brown kids? Sanabria Cooper said. They deserve the same treatment than other kids have. Even a Milton school official questioned the fairness of the town's tactics after noting the one quarter of the students expelled during one school year were allowed to re-enroll. If 20 5% of removals come back to the system, Vaivu Milton's director of data and analytics asked in a September 2024 email to then Superintendent Peter Burrows and others. Then, is our removal process efficient, accurate, and equitable? Phelan and school committee chairperson Mark Laurie declined interview requests in a statement. Phelan said he would not address how residency investigations were handled prior to his appointment in June 2025. In his statement, Phelan said he had been personally involved in every residency case during his tenure to ensure fairness. The records provided by the town show that since Phelan took charge, officials stopped tracking the race and other characteristics of students investigated. That made it impossible to determine whether children were scrutinized equitably. Police Chief John King also declined to be interviewed and would not make his officers available for comment. In an email, King said the two officers work full-time for schools when they are open and otherwise assigned to the police department. The officers are each paid roughly $125,000 annually, which includes almost $15,000 to serve as school resource officers, according to King and Milton payroll records. When assigned to the school, the officers conduct surveillance and home visits for residency investigations. But King said that for the work they do not wear police uniforms or drive cruisers. They do not use police equipment, King said. They identify as working for the schools. But a black mother of a Milton student disputed King's account. The mother resides outside Milton, but her child lives with a grandparent in town and attends Milton schools. She spoke on a condition of anonymity because she feared retaliation. In 2022, a Milton police officer in full uniform arrived in a marked cruiser to conduct a home residency check at the grandmother's house, she said. It lasted less than 5 minutes. She showed the officer her son's bedroom, and the officer left, she said. The officer never presented a warrant, but the mother felt she had no choice but to consent to the search. It's an intimidation tactic, said the mother, adding. You feel almost like you're a criminal, and you haven't done anything wrong. Please. After Michigan, Democrats vow to unite. Progressives win in a bitter primary still may leave deep scars. By Jim Pasangera and Sam Brody of Globe Staff. Democrats' fiercest internal battle of this election year ended on Wednesday with a victory for the unabashed progressive candidate in Michigan's Senate primary. But now the big challenge for Democrats starts, unifying around their nominee, Abdul El-Sayed, that has sweeping stakes for the party's chance to retake the Senate's majority this November, as well as for its broader struggle to redefine the Democratic identity heading into the 2028 presidential election. After such an intense primary, the work won't be easy. El-Sayed and his top rivals, the more moderate Representative Haley Stevens, slugged it out during a bitter and sometimes personal campaign. Despite polls predicting he'd win easily, El-Sayed ultimately prevailed by a narrow margin, roughly one percentage point, underscoring the divisions over the party's direction in President Trump's second term. On Wednesday, the public message was all about coming together. Stevens called El-Sayed to concede and urged Democrats to unify behind the progressive public health official to defeat the Republican nominee. Former Representative Mike Rogers, State Senator Mallory McMurrow, who ran in the Democratic primary before dropping out last month, appeared with El-Sayed to endorse him. Whatever differences that we might have had in the primary, they pale in comparison to what unifies us, El-Sayed said Wednesday. All of us have come together to make sure that we never let Mike Rogers see the inside of the U.S. Senate. Democrats in Washington who had not supported El-Sayed also called for rallying around him. Judge in Massachusetts feeling more heat from Trump team. By Sean Cotter, Globe Staff. A federal judge in Massachusetts is the latest member of the bench to clash with the Trump administration and other Republicans over immigration policies, with one top official publicly criticizing her and a GOP congressman reportedly calling for her impeachment. The jurist is Judge Allison D. Burroughs, who served on the bench of the Federal District Court in Boston since 2014, and previously was a prosecutor in the U.S. Attorney's Office. The tension revolves around her handling of one of the many cases challenging President Trump's move to terminate a government program called Temporary Protected Status that gives immigrants from countries facing violence or devastation, such as natural disasters, legal authority to be in the United States. Many of the suits have been filed at Federal District Court in Boston, and its judges, as well as those on the appellate court above it, are seen as more liberal and more willing to go against Trump. In her most recent writings on Tuesday, Burroughs described the administration's approach to ending TPS as one of shameful cruelty, and a top lawyer for the government responded by labeling her as grumpy. The case before Burroughs was brought by immigrants from Somalia, and in March she had ordered a temporary halt to the administration's efforts to terminate it. But in June, the Supreme Court limited the ability of lower court judges to block the president's authority on national policies, such as TPS. Then in July, James Percival, general counsel for the Department of Homeland Security, included Burroughs in his criticism of multiple judges, noting she was appointed by former President Barack Obama. In particular, Percival took issues with what he characterized as Burroughs' deliberately sluggish briefing schedule for arguments over ending TPS for Somalians. This is a transparent attempt to delay our deportation efforts, effectively granting Somalis a wind-down period that DHS expressively declined to grant, he wrote on the social media platform X. The Trump administration has singled out other federal judges in public before. Just recently, Percival posted a thread that started with, "This week is worst of the worst district judges," and included Burroughs and a judge in Florida who had criticized him. Indeed, federal judges have been an unusually prominent role in the fight over some of Trump's signature policies during his second term. Last year, in a 161-page decision, U.S. District Judge William G. Young sharply rebuked that Trump White House for targeting international students with threats of deportation because of their political beliefs, leading an administration spokesperson to call him craven and labeling his criticism of immigration agents as dishonorable. Meanwhile, U.S. District Judge Brian Murphy, also of Massachusetts, has drawn the ire of the administration for extending TPS protections for Ethiopians. Few federal judges have clashed with the administration more than U.S. District Court Judge John J. McConnell Jr. of Rhode Island, who has ruled against the president's immigration crackdown in multiple cases. He's spoken publicly about receiving what he's characterized as death threats. In June, a Republican congressman from Florida introduced a resolution to impeach McConnell for high crimes and misdemeanors. The criticism of Burroughs comes while she presides over an active TPS case. After the organizations representing Somalians filed an amendment complaint last week, she issued yet another temporary hold on terminations of the program in order to hear additional arguments from both sides. Burroughs wrote that the additional time was necessary because of new issues raised by the amendment complaint, which included additional examples of racial animus the plaintiffs allege is behind Trump's desire to end TPS for those countries.
We'll be right back. News of the nation now. ICE threatens sheriffs with prosecution. Legal experts say charges won't stick. Reported by Ernesto Lodano and Hamed Alaziz of the New York Times. Dateline Minneapolis.
Federal officials recently started threatening to seek criminal charges against two elected county sheriffs who have declined to give immigration agents broad access to inmates subject to deportation. The threats to prosecute two sheriffs in Minneapolis and Chicago, cities that have experienced some of the most intense immigration enforcement of the Trump era, are a new salvo in the president's campaign against state and local officials who refuse to embrace his administration's crackdown. The warnings have been conveyed in a series of letters that federal agents began hand-delivering in early July to Sheriff Dawana Witt of Hennepin County, Minnesota, which includes Minneapolis, and Sheriff Tom Dart of Cook County, Illinois, which includes Chicago. Both are Democrats. The letters assert that failing to hand over inmates being sought by immigration agents could lead each elected official to be charged in federal court with witness tampering, which is a felony. The New York Times reviewed the letters. Legal experts say it would be difficult, if not impossible, for federal prosecutors to charge the sheriffs with witness tampering, let alone prove the elements of the offense, but the threats are part of the Trump administration effort to portray so-called sanctuary jurisdictions as obstacles to the president's mass deportation campaign. The Justice Department has sued several local governments over their unwillingness to cooperate on immigration enforcement. Federal judges in Illinois and Minnesota have dismissed two lawsuits in which Witt and Dart were defendants, ruling the Constitution gives states and cities the authority to refrain from assisting with immigration enforcement. Witt said the threat of prosecution, which has not been previously reported, would not lead her to rescind the department's longstanding policy under which requests from Immigration and Customs Enforcement seeking to take custody of inmates are honored only if there is a warrant from a judge. This is a scare tactic, Witt said in an interview last week. Speaking in her office in downtown Minneapolis, which faces the federal courthouse, Witt also dared the federal government to make good on its threat. "I don't want to be arrested," she said, "but they know where I am. Come and get me." In an emailed statement, the Department of Homeland Security said the letters were an effort to compel sanctuary politicians to hand over dangerous criminals so they can be deported. The moon rocket collision that no one saw. Search begins for debris field on SpaceX stage, reported by Kenneth Chang of the New York Times. If a rocket stage crashes into the moon and no one sees it, did it really crash? A discarded upper stage of the SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket slammed into the surface of the moon around 2:35 a.m. Eastern Time Wednesday at a speed of 5,400 miles per hour. However, it appears no one has yet reported any obvious signs of the impact. Astronomers hope that the collision would create a bright enough flash of light and a big enough cloud of dust and debris that it would be observed through telescopes from Earth. But at the appointed time, the moon looked like the moon. More subtle observations taken by the Lowell Discovery Telescope in Arizona and the Very Large Telescope in Chile could reveal evidence of the collision, including specific wavelengths of light emitted or absorbed by the plume of debris, but the data needs to be analyzed. "We are able to observe despite intermittent thick clouds, but need to do some quick reduction on the data to know if we saw anything," said Patrick Lyrell, a Boston University astronomer involved with the Lowell Discovery observations. "So the answer is nothing yet." The most promising observations so far come from Chile. Another Boston University scientist, Carl Schmidt, used the Very Large Telescope to measure sodium and lithium in a plume a few tens of kilometers in size that lasted 5 to 10 minutes after impact. Schmidt said he was 100% confident that the readings came from the impact. However, it seems no one was able to directly see or photograph the collision. Judge criticizes DOJ in dismissal of January 6th case, reported by Alan Durkin Richer of the Associated Press, Dateline Washington. A federal judge decried efforts to rewrite the history of the January 6, 2021 attack on the Capitol as he reluctantly dismissed the seditious conspiracy case against members of the far-right Oath Keepers extremist group at the Trump administration's request. The move Tuesday closes the book on the January 6 case that was wiped out with Republican President Trump's sweeping pardons and commutations last year, freeing from prison people convicted of violent assaults on police and other crimes. The Department of Justice in April acted to vacate the convictions of Oath Keepers founder Stuart Rhodes and others in the seditious conspiracy cases who had their sentences commuted but did not receive pardons. It was a stunning reversal for the Democratic Biden administrations. Puerto Rico, cities hit with water rationing, reported by Danica Cotto of the Associated Press, Dateline San Juan, Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico will implement water rationing measures in San Juan and other major cities as drought grips U.S. territories with no relief in sight. More than 180,000 customers will be without water for 48 hours at a time starting Friday as part of an alternating schedule while Puerto Rico scrambles to find a solution to the crisis as extreme heat warnings persist. The situation is out of our hands, Governor Jennifer Gonzalez said as she blamed weather conditions. Nothing prevents this from worsening. July was the driest month on record for Puerto Rico in more than 120 years and the second hottest for the capital. Almost 25% of Puerto Rico is experiencing a severe drought and another 36% is under a moderate drought, according to the U.S. Drought Monitor. Judge won't make clerk pay legal fees for Murdaugh, reported by Jeffrey Collins of the Associated Press at Dateline Columbia, South Carolina. A federal judge has thrown out a lawsuit by Alex Murdaugh seeking $600,000 in legal fees by the former court clerk whose misconduct led his murder convictions to be overturned on appeal. Murdaugh sued Becky Hill in May, saying she violated his right to a fair trial in the deaths of his wife and son. A jury found Murdaugh guilty, but the state Supreme Court overturned the convictions and life sentences earlier this year, saying Hill's comments to jurors suggested the lawyer was guilty and his testimony in his own defense could not be trusted. The problem with Murdaugh's legal reasoning is he would have had to spend the money anyways because it wasn't Hill who investigated or pursued justice against him, Judge Richard Gergel wrote in his ruling.
Did you know ADA paratransit riders in Worcester, Auburn, Boylston, Leicester, Northboro, Oxford, Westboro, and West Boylston now have the option to schedule trips through the Worcester Regional Transit Authority's new online reservation system. Call customer service at 508-791-9782 or email paratransit@therta.com to begin scheduling your trip online.
At least 17 killed in air attacks on Kyiv. Strikes exploit Ukraine's spent air defenses, reported by Mark Santora of the New York Times. Russia launched a blistering ballistic missile attack on Kyiv, the Ukrainian capital, and its suburbs before dawn on Wednesday, killing at least 17 people and wounding dozens more, Ukrainian officials said, as Moscow takes advantage of Ukraine's depleted air defenses. The attack set off large blazes and filled the skies with smoke as rescue workers raced to find survivors in the rubble of a city that is now largely defenseless against ballistic missile strikes. It was the third major attack on the capital in a week as Ukraine runs desperately low on interceptor missiles for its Patriot batteries, the only reliable defense against Russia's most sophisticated missiles. Ballistic missile interceptors could have saved the lives of those killed today, President Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine said in a statement, putting the initial death toll at 17. It is very important that our partners understand that delays in supplying them or an unwillingness to provide anti-ballistic systems lead directly to such horrific casualties and destruction. The shortage of interceptors has become a wider problem as the wars in Ukraine and the Middle East drain military stockpiles around the world. Late last month, President Trump put aside plans to escalate attacks on Iran after advisors raised concerns about the dwindling U.S. supplies of Patriot systems and other anti-missile munitions. Trump appeared to have provided Ukraine with an alternate path toward improving air defenses when he said last month the United States would share the technology for producing Patriot missiles with Ukraine, but later he backed off that promise, saying, "We have not agreed to that. Ukraine is working to develop its own version of the Patriot system, but the country cannot currently make an air defense system as effective." Iran and U.S. say Hormuz deal near. Tehran and Oman move closer to an agreement on the waterway. Reported by Elena Bekatoros, Sammy Madge, and Darlene Superville of the Associated Press. Dateline Cairo. Iran said Wednesday it is in the final stage of drafting an agreement with Oman over the Strait of Hormuz, and President Trump has said a deal could be announced this week that could potentially reopen the critical waterway, ease pressure on the world economy, and help bring an end to the war. But the agreement is likely to be contingent on the United States lifting its blockade on Iran's ports. The Trump administration has previously ruled out any deal that would cement Iran's grip over the strait, which would amount to a major loss for the United States and a break with global norms. Iran has insisted on some measure of control over the strait, saying it will not go back to being an open international waterway as it was before the war. The United States, along with Israel, launched the war on February 28th, citing various goals, including toppling Tehran's government and ending its nuclear program. Those have not been achieved, and the conflict has devolved into a fight over the strait as Iran's assertion of control and attacks on shipping have ground traffic to a near halt. Closure of the strait, through which a fifth of the world's traded oil and natural gas once passed, has driven up the price of fuel and basic goods, roiling the global economy. Trump is also under mounting pressure to end an unpopular war ahead of U.S. congressional elections. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman said the agreement with Oman is in the final stage of drafting and that a joint statement will be issued if certain parties do not obstruct this process, apparently referring to the United States. Iranian and Omani negotiators have finalized the draft deal to reopen the strait and await final approval from Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Mojibtah Khamenei, two regional officials said Wednesday. Khamenei is believed to have been wounded in the war's opening strikes and has not been seen in public since then. The officials who were briefed on the negotiations portrayed the potential deal as a temporary solution to the dispute over the strait. They said it is tied to an agreement reached between the United States and Iran in June that aimed at ending the fighting and reopened the waterway, but ultimately collapsed. Four men stabbed in London. London police said Wednesday that a woman had been arrested after four people were stabbed in Covent Garden, a bustling area in the center of the capital that is full of attractions and popular with visitors. The Metropolitan Police said four men aged 34, 39, 42, and 52 were found with stab wounds, and that a 47-year-old woman was arrested on suspicion of possession of an offensive weapon and assault. They said early indications suggested that it was a mental health-related incident and that scissors were recovered at the scene. The injured were taken to a major trauma center following the incident early afternoon Wednesday in Endell Street. No further update has been given on the extent of the injuries. There was a significant police cordon around the scene. The London Ambulance Service spokesman said the service treated four patients at the scene and took them all to a major trauma center. Police previously said that three people had been stabbed in the incident, but in a statement they later confirmed four people suffered stab wounds. Iran and U.S. Oh, that's the wrong story. WHO, Ebola outrunning response. Dateline, Kinshasa, Congo. The world's fastest growing Ebola outbreak is spreading faster than efforts to fight it, the head of the World Health Organization said on Wednesday during a visit to Congo, where some health workers are striking over lack of pay. Nearly 3 months into the outbreak, new cases are doubling in some hotspots. Tedros Adhanom said in a post on X after meeting with officials in the capital, Kinshasa. It was the second visit by the WHO Director General to the Central African country since the outbreak was declared in mid-May. We all agree that we must urgently and massively scale up our efforts across all pillars of the response and by all partners, he said. The outbreak has accounted for 3,800 confirmed cases, including more than 1,700 deaths as of Monday, according to Congo's Ministry of Health data. In Ituri Province, the epicenter of the outbreak, families said many frontline workers have gone on strike, worsening access to health care that was already challenged by rebel conflicts in one of Congo's most remote and vulnerable areas. It's east near the borders of South Sudan, Uganda, and Rwanda. Hope to visit Uruguay, Argentina, Peru, and in first Latin American trip as pontiff, Dateline Vatican City. Pope Leo XIV will make his first trip to Latin America as pontiff in November, returning to a region where he spent much of his ministry with visits to Uruguay, Argentina, and Peru, the Vatican announced on Wednesday. The November 6th through 17th trip will include stops in Monteverde, Paysandú, and Florida in Uruguay, Buenos Aires, Corbona, and Luján in Argentina, and Lima, Chicola, Cusco, and Pucallpa in Peru. The visit is especially significant because of Leo's long-standing ties to Peru. The first U.S.-born pope spent decades there as a missionary and church leader and served as bishop from 2015 to 2023. He also holds Peruvian citizenship. His return to Chiclayo, the diocese he led before his election, is expected to be one of the key moments of the trip. Leo will also visit Argentina, the homeland of his predecessor, the late Pope Francis. Despite repeated invitations, Francis, the first Latin American pope, never returned to Argentina during his 12-year papacy. Climbers' bodies recovered from Pakistan Peak, Dateline Islamabad. Search teams, backed by military helicopters, recovered the bodies of renowned British Nepali mountaineer Nirmal Purja and three other missing climbers on Wednesday, bringing the number of bodies recovered from Broad Peak to seven, nearly a week after an avalanche swept away a 10-member international expedition, officials said Wednesday. The Alpine Club of Pakistan said the operation was one of the most technically demanding recovery missions ever carried out on the mountains. It said the bodies of Purja, Chinese climber Zhang Wang, and Nepali climbers Nima Sherpa and Kilu Sherpa were brought to Broad Peak Base Camp. Search teams brought down three other bodies on August 1st. The bodies will be transported to a military hospital in Skardu when weather conditions permit, local officials said. In Nepal's capital, Kathmandu, family members, friends, and supporters of the climbers gathered Tuesday evening for a candlelight vigil. Buddhist monks chanted prayers as mourners observed a moment of silence before lighting candles in memories of those killed in the avalanche. The climbers, who came from Nepal, Oman, Pakistan, China, Britain, and the United States, were swept away by an avalanche last Thursday in Pakistan's northern Gilt-Baltistan region in what the Alpine Club has described as one of the country's deadliest mountaineering disasters. Pakistan's foreign minister expressed condolences to the families of those killed, saying he was deeply saddened by the tragedy, and Pakistan remained committed to the ongoing operation in coordination with the embassies of Nepal, Oman, Britain, and the United States. More news from the Boston Globe coming up.
Bay State Council of the Blind is an organization created by and for people with vision loss. We seek to improve the lives of people who are blind and those who have low vision in Massachusetts. We work on accessibility, advocacy in all walks of life, transportation, voting, employment, education, health, and the arts. We enjoy getting together to socialize and to support each other. Our Central Mass chapter meets in Worcester every other month on the third Saturday at 10 a.m. in person and on Zoom. We are currently meeting at the offices of Audio Journal at 799 West Boylston Street in Worcester. We are trying to resume a few social events now, and we definitely work on advocacy issues such as monitoring our Massachusetts Commission for the Blind Services and local transportation. For more information, please call Bay State Council of the Blind Central Mass Chapter President Mary Haroyan at 774-232-8036. That's Mary Haroyan at 774-232-8036. Or send an email to mharoyan@charter.net. That's mharoyan@charter.net. We welcome you into our community. All right, now to the Metro section of the Boston Globe. Again, we are reading from the Thursday, August 6th, 2026 edition. The top story from the Metro section, Healy signs law limiting ICE arrest in state. This story by Chris Van Buskirk of the Globe staff. Dateline Chelsea. Democrats on Beacon Hill have spent most of the last year plus promising plans to counteract the Trump administration on everything from federal funding to reproductive rights. On Wednesday, they cemented their most forceful rebuttal to the president, pushing into law a sweeping immigration bill designed to thwart Trump's nationwide deportation surges that have led to fatal shootings across the nation and thousands of arrests in Massachusetts alone. At the core of the now law is language intended to block immigration and customs enforcement agents from detaining immigrants in sensitive areas such as public schools, child care centers, and healthcare providers. I'm going to repeat that again. At the core of this new law is language intended to block ICE agents from detaining immigrants in sensitive areas, such as public schools, child care centers, and healthcare providers. That also includes a ban on warrantless civil immigration arrest at state courthouses, at a time when judges and trial court officials have said federal immigration agents are a common sight. In signing the bill, Governor Maura Healey secured another bulwark against the Trump administration while also giving herself and other local Democrats fodder for their reelection campaigns this summer and fall. Healey was quick to lean into politics at an event packed with lawmakers, advocates, and others, tying ICE deportation operations to the hateful and racist agenda of Trump and Stephen Miller, the president's deputy chief of staff and influential advisor on immigration. Today, we the people of Massachusetts are standing up and are fighting back because we know what we need to do. We know that what ICE is doing is wrong and it needs to stop, Healey said. What we're doing today is standing up to a president, to an administration that's out of control, that's hurting people, hurting neighborhoods across our country. Our next story from the Metro section. His classroom became a forum of ideas. With a people's history as his text, he taught for years at Cambridge, Ringe, and Latin. This story is by Brian Marquard of The Globe. When Larry Aronson was growing up in Washington, D.C., racism was a wrought iron fence that separated white children in the sandbox behind his apartment house from the sandbox next door, where black children played. That memory loomed as a powerful image of the message segregated society sent about separating children by the color of their skin in the early 1940s, though it took years for him to fully grasp the implications. As a youth, he said in an oral history interview, "I was clueless about race." Then in the mid-1960s, he became a teacher by accident, landing a job he hadn't expected to get. Mr. Aronson found his life's calling and learned from his students and civil rights activists about how white history dominated textbooks and how people of color were erased from school curriculum. He said those first years of becoming radicalized gradually by the experience of being a teacher helped him understand that public schools were the citadel of our democracy. Social studies, in particular, was the crucible. Mr. Aronson, who later moved north and became a charismatic and influential teacher at Cambridge, Ringe, and Latin School, was 85 when he died Saturday in Neville Center at Fresh Pond in Cambridge. He had long been diagnosed with chronic lymphoblastic leukemia and had been living in Somerville. With A People's History of the United States as his textbook, written by Howard Zinn, Mr. Aronson encouraged hundreds of students over the years to ask their own questions about the world around them. He told us to put away our other history books, the traditional ones, and he taught Howard Zinn's book. "It was pretty wonderful," said Rima Freeman, who was a Cambridge, Ringe, and Latin student when she first walked into Mr. Aronson's history class. As a teacher, she added, he made it fun to be in his class, to be part of alternative education, and really learning. Mr. Aronson, who retired in 2007, told students to keep learning and questioning after their school days were done, and they went into the world to take action and never give up hope. "I would describe him as the most intense optimist I've ever met," said Nate Albert, a former guitarist for the band The Mighty Mighty Bosstones and a former student of Mr. Aronson's. "He just had this belief in us and belief in the world that you can make it right." The number of lives Mr. Aronson touched seemed impossible for friends and admirers to calculate. More than 700 comments and condolences have been posted on Saturday's announcement on his Facebook page that he had died. "Larry, you are just simply one of the best to ever do this thing called life," read one. "Your legacy will live on through so many of us." Along with teaching, Mr. Aronson was a devoted photographer, recording so many school and community events and images from everyday life that an archivist has been tapped to sort through his voluminous collection. His former students range from the famous, including Ben Affleck and Matt Damon, to seemingly every second or third person he passed on the street. Walking through Cambridge alongside Mr. Aronson was a stop-and-start affair. Literally, bus drivers would be waving from buses and shopkeepers would be walking out to say hi, and he taught them all, said his cousin Sarabin Levy Brightman of Belmont, whose teaching years at Cambridge, Rin, and Latin overlapped with Mr. Aronson's. This was his community. Earlier this week, Cambridge City Councilors Mark McGovern and E. Denise Simmons and Mayor Sumbul Siddiqui sponsored a resolution honoring Mr. Aronson's life and work. Through his commitment to progressive education, his belief in the transformative power of public schools, and his unwavering encouragement of independent thought, Larry helped shape the lives and careers of countless young people. many of whom went on to dedicate themselves to public service and social justice. The resolution said, in part. Our final story from the Metro section. This farm safari really moves. A cow safari has taken many to Framingham since an influencer posted about it in early June. This story is by Ty Theodoro of The Globe. Dateline Framingham. Visitors are flocking to this small city off the pike for a safari unlike any other. The excursion requires no binoculars, and instead of savage beast, attendees are greeted by about a dozen friendly cattle with long pink tongues that are eager to snatch bread from the hands of those traveling around in a wagon. Eastleigh Farms Cow Safaris recently went viral after a social media account for parents in Metro West looking for things to do shared a video of the experience, racking up 2.4 million views on Instagram and TikTok combined. Daily attendance at the farm safari shot up from fewer than 70 people to as many as 600. "I'm a great believer in the right thing happens for the right reason at the right time," said Doug Steffen, age 79, the farm's owner. The farm's cow safaris are just one example of the agritourism boom that's spreading across Massachusetts farmlands, generating multi-millions of dollars in revenue every year. Agritourism can take many forms, varying from farm stays, vineyard tours, and pick-your-own orchards to hay rides, corn mazes, harvest festivals, and animal encounters like the cow safaris. In Massachusetts, agritourism revenue grew from $13 million in 2017 to $23 million in 2022, even as the overall number of farms has declined. The agritourism surge comes as Massachusetts farms have faced mounting headwinds from cuts in federal programs to natural disasters. Between 97 and 22, the state lost 113,000 acres of farmland, equaling about 21% of the state's total, according to the 2022 Census of Agriculture. The American Farmland Trust, a national nonprofit that works to protect agricultural land, projects that Massachusetts could lose up to 1,200 farms and 89,000 acres of farmland between 2016 and 2040 without further investment and policy action. Against that backdrop, agritourism has emerged as one way for farms to diversify their revenue and shore up their finances, according to experts. We're going to take a quick break and invite Mr. Bill to come into the live studio to give us our daily weather report. We'll be right back.
Wait, I gotta shut off my phone. All right, I'll do it now. Hello. Ladies and gentlemen, and good afternoon. This is meteorologist Bill Gerio with your latest weather forecast. Well, we do have some thunderstorms coming in after 3 p.m. Some of them are going to be potent and heavy. Looks like the thunderstorms has popped up over Orange and Athol and moving in towards Templeton. They'll be there in the next 10 or 15 minutes, and then it'll hit the Gardner area, Westminster, Fitchburg, Leominster, and then move into the Worcester area, and we'll be in the Boston area by about 4 or 5 o'clock. And so thunderstorms will continue tonight. Lows will be in the mid-70s. Now tomorrow it's going to be hazy, hot, and humid. We have the heat advisory until 8 p.m. tomorrow, and then we've got some thunderstorms coming in. Saturday's going to be hot. Sunday might cool down into the 70s. Monday, Tuesday in the 70s. And then we heat it up again next week through the end of next week with some showers and thunderstorms. Now back to you, Harry, with our Boston Globe.
Thank you very much, Bill. I think we're going to nickname you Thunderstorm Bill. You came in here like a storm to give us the weather. We really appreciate that.
Yes, yes, I did.
Okay, well, we'll be right back with a few sport, maybe one or two sports stories from Mark. So please stay tuned.
Yeah. Who is that?
This is Corey.
Hi, Corey. And Mark is here. Hi, Mark.
With sports, first Gray Red Sox stellar from start, reported by Julian Benbow of the Boston Globe staff. At 36 and in his 14th major league season, Sonny Gray is having one of the best years of his career in his first season with the Red Sox. His impact as a presence in the clubhouse is just as valuable, said Red Sox interim manager Chad Tracy. He's enormous, Tracy said, because of who he is, the amount of time he's got in the big leagues, the amount of knowledge he has, the way he prepares. Gray helped the Red Sox extend their winning streak to 7 games, throwing 6 scoreless innings Wednesday night in a 4-0 win over the White Sox at Fenway Park. He struck out 8 while allowing just 3 hits and 2 walks, earning his American League leading 14th win of the season. He was awesome, Tracy said. Very locked in and determined from the time he got here. He executed his pitches, pretty much had spin whenever he wanted to, got a lot of spin below the zone for swing and miss. Just really, really a good outing. The Red Sox, 62-51, climbed to a season-high 11 games above 500, winning 30 of their last 35, marking the best 35-game stretch in franchise history to clinch their 9th consecutive series victory. A column from Peter Abraham on baseball. Rafaela now on all around, now an all-around major league talent. That the Red Sox would have one of the best all-around players in baseball in their outfield this season wasn't unexpected. That it proved to be Seydon Rafaela and not Roman Anthony is the surprising part. Rafaela arrived at Fenway Park for Wednesday night's game, 4-0 victory over the White Sox with a 5.4 BWAR, the all-encompassing statistic as calculated by baseballreference.com. That's tied for the third among the position players with Marlins shortstop Otto Lopez, only Cubs center fielder Peter Crow Armstrong and Astros slugger Jordan Alvarez have more. A large percentage of Rafaela's value is his outstanding defense in center field, but this season has featured a significant improvement at the plate with career bests in batting average, .287, on base percentage, .329, and slugging percentage, .475. Through Thursday, he was tied for second in the majors in doubles with 28. Rafaela also made the All-Star team for the first time He's earned it, said Willier Abreu, Rafaela's good friend and fellow outfielder. The consistency he has now and the routine he created to improve his hitting has been very impressive. Rafaela, who turns 26 next month, was a scattershot hitter from 2024 to 25. His first full two seasons in the majors, he collected 97 extra base hits, but also struck out 268 times, 23% of his plate appearances. This year, he raised his slugging percentage 12% and cut his strikeouts by 3%. Rafaela has gotten to a three-ball count 46 times this season. He did that only 56 times in all of 2025. He's controlling the at-bat a lot better than he has in the past, teammate Trevor Story said. He's going up there with a plan and carrying it out. It is a big difference. And an On Football column by Ben Violin. Jack is concerned already. When rookie Gabe Jackus finally hit the practice field Saturday for the first time, the Patriots had a plan. Don't leave him alone for a minute. Outside linebackers coach Mike Smith was attached to Jackus's hip for 2 hours. When the Patriots practiced punt protection drills, they stopped the drill before each of Jackus's reps to teach him the technique. When they moved to the next practice period, Jackus got 10 minutes of one-on-one coaching from Mike Vrabel. We've got to make up for lost time a little bit with Gabe, Vrabel said. Vrabel could barely contain his excitement when the Patriots traded up to draft Jackus with the 55th pick in April's draft, calling him everything we are about in his introductory phone call with Jackus. But after a surprise knee injury delayed the start of the player's career, the Patriots are now doing everything they can to prevent him from becoming another one of their second round busts. Harry?
All right. Thank you, Mark. Well, folks, that's the end of our live Boston Globe show. I want to thank Corey, Bill, and Mark for joining us today. As always, thanks to the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Mass Commission for the Blind, who year after year supports us. And remember, folks, during the times when it's this hot, drink lots of water, and don't be shy to ask help. There's always help available at your local senior center, your local public library, and any town offices. Be kind to one another, take care, and have a great day.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Hello, once again, audio journal listeners. Here's your latest weather forecast for Thursday, August 6th, 2026. Here's my latest forecast. For today, we'll get mostly sunny skies, warm and humid, with scattered afternoon showers and heavy thunderstorms. Some of the storms could bring heavy rainfall. Highs today near 88 degrees. For tonight, warm and humid with showers and thunderstorms likely. Low around 70 degrees. Now the outlook for Friday is calm for morning thunderstorm, otherwise clearing the afternoon. Then more showers and thunderstorms by evening. Highs Friday in the lower 90s. Friday night, mostly cloudy skies with showers and thunderstorms likely, low around 69 degrees, and the outlook for Saturday is calm for hazy, warm, and humid with afternoon showers and heavy thunderstorms again on Saturday, highs Saturday in the mid-80s. That, folks, is your latest weather forecast for Thursday, August 6th, 2026. This has been Bill Ruggiero saying have a good and happy day, everybody, and please stay tuned for more programming up next on Audio Journal. Take it easy, everybody. Have a great day. Bye.
Are you elderly or disabled? Did you know each WRTA fixed route bus has a number of accessibility features such as a ramp to enter, a kneeler which can lower the bus, a securement area for wheelchairs and other mobility devices, priority seating for people with disabilities, electronic signage on the front, side, and rear exterior, a bicycle rack on the front exterior, an interior stop request sign, automated audio and visual stop announcements. Let us make your transportation needs easier and ride the bus with us. Call us with questions at 508-791-9782 or visit our website at www.therta.com.
Hi, the Bay State Council of the Blind has available free Braille copies of a new publication from the CDC. It's entitled COVID-19 Vaccination Guidance, and this one-volume publication focuses on information about the vaccines and vaccine safety. To get your free copy, send your name and mailing address to kim.charlson@perkins.org. That's kim.charlson@perkins.org.